Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the great director Danny Boyle talks about the return of 28 Days in 28 Years Later. He also talks a bit about his long career, everything from Trainspotting to Slumdog Millionaire. We review all the week's new TV releases, including the very controversial movie Rust with Alec Baldwin. And of course, all the TV you want to stream or skip. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcast, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you've had a sun-soaked week, because it seems to have been pretty much everywhere. Lots of sunscreen in this house because it was essential. We seem to spend the week slathering children in sun cream, but I hope you had a sun-soaked week. And as I'm talking to you now, it's about 25 degrees where I am, which is positively Mediterranean, you might say. I was at a stag party since I spoke to you last. One of my best mates is getting married, and there's nothing quite like a gang of men in their late 40s going out for a stag party. It was all very, very tame. I haven't been in a stag party in years, and this was probably the antithesis of what stag parties traditionally are. You know, this involved men playing darts, drinking red wine at dinner, people taking breaks from drinking, people drinking water. It was all terribly civilized, but great fun, but just kind of, you know, not what a traditional stag is. And maybe that's all for the good. That's all for the good. We're just, you know, looking ruefully on how rock and roll we used to be, or certainly how rock and roll we thought we were. Let's get to the business at hand, because we've lots to cover. Now, first of all, in TV this week, I was watching this.
I'm sure, Lord Advocate, with your weight, you can get a deserving candidate fast-tracked to the DI rank.
I presume you're talking about the Syrian gentleman whom you introduced as your bodyguard?
He's a political refugee who's here on asylum, and loath as I am to admit it, he's a good copper. Better than most.
I'll see what I can do.
That would be lovely. Thank you. Oh, and I'm gonna need a new car. And not some impounded piece of shit with some tired pool car.
Any particular make and model?
I don't know. What do you drive?
Yes, you heard the great Matthew Good there, wanting a car for his new department. His new department is called Department Q. This is from a series on Netflix called Department Q. And Matthew Good, who people probably know best from Downton Abbey. And in this, he plays a cop called Mork, who's really good at his job, but he's an asshole, if you'll pardon my, I don't know what you call it, French, if you pardon my inclement speech. And he really rubs people up the wrong way, but he's had a bit of a tragedy wherein he was investigating a case, and on his watch at a crime scene, a young policeman gets shot and his colleague ends up getting paralyzed. He comes back to work and he's kind of demoted to this Department Q because a load of money has come in and they're going to set up different departments. This is all set in Scotland. It's based on a Scandi series of novels, but they've transferred the action to Edinburgh. So that Nordic bleakness is now Scottish bleakness. And anyway, Mork sets up this department, kind of a cold case department, and he doesn't really want to do it, but as you can tell, he kind of gets into it. His chief case of a young advocate, Merritt Lingard, she disappeared, and he traces her story and we see her story in tandem with that. What's also funny and interesting about this is that in this new department he's sent to, the cold case one, he's given this guy as a kind of PA to him or an assistant, but it turns out he was a Syrian refugee and a former police officer, Akram, played by a great actor, Alexei Manilov. And he kind of becomes his partner, even though Matthew Good doesn't really want him in it. Matthew Good is also dealing with the guilt of people having died on his watch. This reminds me a bit of Slow Horses. It's really very good. It's gripping. It's kind of slow, but not too slow. It has a brilliant series of cases. His own case, this case of the missing woman, his own personal drama. He's looking after a young boy who may or may not be his son. It's brilliant so far. I'm about four episodes in. Matthew Good is in the vein of a real anti-hero. Great at his job, kind of annoying to everyone else. A touch of Robbie Coltrane in Cracker, touch of the great Gary Oldman in Slow Horses, in that reluctant cop who's half a hero but also a jackass. Although Cracker, Robbie Coltrane was a clinical psychologist, but you know what I mean. So Department Q, it's nine episodes. It's really, really, really good. Something else on Netflix that I want to quickly mention is a very entertaining, somewhat tragic documentary. Trainwreck is this series they have on Netflix, where things go very badly. There's one called Mayor of Mayhem, all about Rob Ford, who was the Toronto mayor back in the about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, 2013. Some seeing as a precursor to Trump because he was a no-holds-bar, almost anti-politics politician who told it like it was as he saw it and didn't have any time for City Hall and the normal constraints of political life, and as he saw it, just tried to get the job done. He turned out to be very popular in Toronto. And it turns out there was a video of him doing the rounds smoking crack. Yes, folks, smoking crack. And he wasn't that apologetic to a certain extent about that video. And this documentary, it's only about 50 minutes long, charts his career and how he dealt with the scandal and also the unearthing of the scandal, and I guess a kind of proto-Trump character. It's a really good watch. Chaotic, as the name would imply. Trainwreck, Mayor of Mayhem. It's on Netflix now, all about Rob Ford. In terms of movie news, regular listeners will know that I was very, very excited about this.
It's a 305 V8.
Never owned a new car before.
Yeah, it's awfully fitting for a handsome devil rock star. I do know who you are.
Well, that makes one of us.
Hey, boss, can you do a mic check?
How's that sound?
Looks about right.
Don't need to be perfect. I want it to feel like I'm in the room by myself.
Yeah.
Let's try one.
Here's what I want you to understand. This is not about either one of us.
Mm.
This is not about the charts. This is about Bruce Springsteen. And these are the songs that he wants to work on right now.
So standing on our front lawn, just a twirling her baton.
I'm going to tell you a little story. When Bruce was little, he had a hole in the floor of his bedroom.
Me and her fur rats.
The floor that's supposed to be solid.
And
that you're supposed to be able to stand on.
People
Bruce, he didn't have that.
Yes, that is a clip from the new Bruce Springsteen biopic. We've got the first trailer. It's called Deliver Me From Nowhere. Jeremy Allen White plays a young Springsteen. This is all around, it's based on a book and about Bruce Springsteen's recording of the Nebraska album, which is a very dark, gritty kind of album about lost souls. And Springsteen at this time in his career was a very lost soul. It details the making of that album right before he would go interstellar with Born in the USA. Jeremy Allen White plays him and sings. It sounds pretty good to me so far. We don't know much more about it other than that. What we do know is that Stephen Graham plays his father. I suppose the emotional drama in this seems to be Springsteen had a very difficult relationship with his father, who basically suffered from schizophrenia of a certain fashion. And a lot of the movie harks back to his difficult childhood with his dad. So this looks very good so far. Jeremy Allen White looks great and sounds great, I think, as a young Springsteen. Stephen Graham plays his father. So when I spoke to Stephen Graham earlier in the year for the brilliant Netflix series Adolescence, which is continuing to have a very long life and rightly so on Netflix, I asked him about playing Springsteen's dad. And this is what he told me. Yeah. You're playing his dad in a new movie. And for anyone who knows Springsteen, his father looms so large in his creative imagination and his life as well. Is it true that he kind of said to you, you brought my dad back?
I mentioned this and it's gone out and I'm very embarrassed. What he sent me, I had to rush off from filming on my last day because I had to get home on the plane. But I was in prosthetics and stuff like that. And he sent me the most beautiful text I've ever received in my life. And it, you know, look, accolades and awards and all those kind of things are part and parcel of what we do. And they're not important in many ways, but then some people will tell me off and say they are. But they're just shiny things that, you know, sometimes it's about the essence of the human soul in what we do in certain ways. And he sent me the most beautiful text saying, thank you for bringing my father back to life. I haven't seen him for a long time and I saw him today. Jeez. On screen. For him to say something like that, just, you know what I mean? It was beautiful. And he's such a wonderful man. He's such a humble, kind, caring, gentle soul. He's beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah, that's Stephen Graham there talking about playing Springsteen's dad, Doug Springsteen, in the new biopic that we got the trailer for this week, Deliver Me From Nowhere, which we have to wait till October. In the meantime, if you're looking for something Springsteen-esque, he has 7 new lost albums hitting the shelves next week, I think it is. Tracks 2, 7 albums. I checked out the price of them. I was thinking of buying them on CD. Not so sure about that. £250 I was looking at. That's a lot to pay. But let's see. Let's see what happens. In the meantime, well, not in the meantime, it's not till October, there will be a Springsteen biopic of sorts called Deliver Me From Nowhere, starring Jeremy Allen White of The Bear. And we'll see what happens there. Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. And after the break, I'll be talking to the great Danny Boyle about 28 years later. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, let's go here.
There were so many dead. Infected and non-infected alike.
That's why our home is so precious.
You know, I feel he's a bit young.
He's ready, Jen.
7, 6, 11, 5.
Once you walk onto that mainland, there's no rescues.
Moving up and down again. Don't.
Yes, that was a clip of the new release that was out since Thursday of this week, the 19th of June, 28 years later. From the minds, the directorship of Danny Boyle and writer Alex Garland. As you may remember, 28 Days Later came out, it's over 20 years ago now, in 2002, with Cillian Murphy stumbling around empty London streets, emptied by a zombie virus outbreak, and the infected were everywhere. A lot has changed. A lot has happened to the world since that first one. There was a sequel 28 weeks later, which wasn't bad, but now we are back in 2025 with the third iteration. This is a bit different, and I think it's been described as somewhat of a reimagining. It's not really a sequel, though, but what has happened is the infected, the victims of the lab leak rage virus, last shown reaching Europe at the end of 28 weeks later, have been pushed back and reconfined to British shores. So the virus is now contained in Britain. Which obviously has all sorts of real-world parallels, possibly. Among them is 12-year-old Spike, played by Alfie Williams, who lives with his father, Jamie, Aaron Taylor-Joy, and his quite ill mother, Isla, played by Jodie Comer, on Holy Island, off England's north coast. And it's the only place he's ever known. They live a kind of feudal life on this island that's quarantined, and they've a strict policy of not letting anyone get on it because it is clean. So they have this heavily defended causeway that's only accessible at low tide. But of course, they decide to venture out. And what's happened to the infected is now that there are alphas. There's been a variant. There's that scary word. And some of the infected have grown even bigger. I won't say what happens, because let's just say they leave this island and maybe come back and maybe go again. And you can imagine there are all sorts of run-ins with zombies. We also have Ray Fiennes, who's over on the mainland now, who almost seems like Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now, but there is a lot to him, and he's a former doctor living a strange life in this infected Britain. So, you know, COVID and Brexit and all sorts of things happened since the last movie. This is a fascinating watch in terms of, I don't know what the metaphors might be, but it's also a very good horror movie. As I say, it's different to the other ones. It looks a little different. A lot of it was shot on iPhones, believe it or not. So, it is from director Danny Boyle, who is one of the great living directors. Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, 127 Hours, Slumdog Millionaire. Artistic director for the 2012 Summer Olympics in the UK. He wanted to be a priest at one stage in his life when he was a young man. I've waited a long time to talk to him, so I was delighted earlier today to sit down with him in a Dublin hotel and talk to him about 28 years later and a bit more besides. Lovely to meet you.
And you.
Tell me this, the last thing I want to talk to you about is Brexit, believe me, because you're a great filmmaker, but I kept thinking this is some grand metaphor for Brexit.
The intention wasn't that it to be a grand metaphor, but it was definitely that it should pass across the consciousness of the film and the watcher. And you can't help but do that. It's one of the two huge public emergencies that we've had in the UK since we made the first film. The other one is obviously COVID, something that everybody went through. But Brexit is something we chose to go through, or rather the English did. Mm. It's very important. It's very much an English vote. Scotland, for instance, voted to stay in. So it's, and we feature that in the film. You can see them celebrate the Englishness of this decision in a way. But yeah, you can read it like that. But it's a horror movie with its own story, obviously, free of politics.
Absolutely. And it works by itself as a horror movie. Tell me this. I heard the word variant in it, and my blood ran cold because I hadn't heard that in a long time. But the variants are brilliant because they're giant. I know you don't like the phrase zombie necessarily, but they're giant monsters, let's say. Were you having fun with that idea that you were harking back to something COVID-esque by calling them variants?
Oh yeah, very much so. It's obviously the COVID thing we went through. The recognition of the way capital cities, well, any city could be emptied. The unthinkable of these places being transformed overnight into something else. Mm-hmm. But the other thing about COVID was obviously the fact that it evolved as a virus. And then you start to think, well, our virus, our rage virus, would have evolved in as well over 28 years. Mm-hmm. And instead of becoming safer, which COVID generally tended to do, it became easier to deal with, though there are still exceptions to that. This virus becomes more and more powerful by mutating into creatures on the ground called the Slolos, into the infected that you've seen in the first film, who are kind of hunters now and can survive and eat and drink. So they're organized and they've thrown up dominance, a dominant variant, who are the alphas, who are pretty scary.
They are. Mission accomplished in terms of making them scary. Everyone keeps comparing him to Colonel Kurtz from Heart of Darkness and what's the film actually called? Apocalypse Now,
indeed.
But Ray Fiennes is this kind of, it could be suntan lotion at the start, we're not sure, but he's brilliant. Did you have him in mind all along when this character arose?
Yeah, there's not many people can play that.
No.
He's extraordinary. So he's called Dr. Kelson. Yeah. He's a doctor who everybody thinks has gone insane, like Kurtz.
Yeah.
And in fact, he appears to be doing something very Kurtz-like with all these bodies. But actually,
he's on the side of the angels.
Yeah, well, there's a surprise in the film. Yeah. And it gets even more surprising when you meet him in the second film. There's a second film, which we've already shot, which carries on from this. They're standalone films. They can experience them in their own right. But two or three of the characters link through into the next film, and he's one. And his story is even more fully told in that film.
Brilliant. Tell me this. Martin Scorsese, you, John Woo, there's others. They all wanted to be priests.
I knew that was coming.
When they were kids.
Yeah, no, it's true.
You're all great directors. Sorry, I should have said that
well,
first.
Well, it's the same job, isn't it?
But why is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's the same job. You just stand up and tell people what to think. You're telling people what to do and think. It's the same job, poncing around. I don't know. There's also the theatrical.
Yeah.
There is definitely that sense of the theatrical. You like telling stories.
Yeah.
You like holding people with ideas and stories. And I'm not sure whether entertaining them is the right word to describe priests. But I recognised it when I heard.
Yeah.
I recognised it. There's a few others as well, I believe, that have not dabbled in it, but have brushed against it. Yeah, throughout their careers. Yeah.
The Catholic Church has lost, the cinema's gain, or something like that. There's two quick things I want to ask you. I remember in college hearing about a thing called an overdetermined event. So, for instance, when Ireland got to Italia 90 in the World Cup, they described that as an overdetermined event, and our life as a nation nearly changed. I've heard the Olympic ceremony of 2012 described as an overdetermined event, that it was like the UK coming out of something, going to something else, and the national pride felt for it was disproportionately high. Has anyone ever suggested that to you, that there was albeit a very good one, but a really weird reaction? There was an outpouring of approbation for that Olympic ceremony that you produced and directed.
It's funny, I've never heard it described so eloquently.
It wasn't my line, but...
it was very special for people, I think. And I think we did it in the right way. We went about it in the right way. We had the right people in it.
Mm.
We celebrated the right elements of the Olympics, because it's very easy to get drawn into other areas of it, the televised world, sponsors, all that side of it. But when you think about it, it is something extraordinary. We gather around these athletes who are... If we've got alphas in the film, they are our alphas. They are Usain Bolt. You're never going to be able to run as fast as Usain Bolt. And yet, we're not jealous. We celebrate them. We kind of go, there we are. That's what we're capable of. And it was wonderful to do that in conjunction with the volunteers, who this bunch of people who believe in the spirit of these public festivals. And the other thing about is that's why cinema's important, for instance. The more these phones separate us by pretending to let us communicate with each other, the more that public communal events are important, like church, like cinema, like the pub, you know, where you just go and you're in a convivial setting where you actually contribute to something, even though you don't know people. You contribute to a spirit.
Well, that's a very eloquent defense of cinema, and I hope everyone goes to see this. The last thing is, and this is the opposite of eloquence, you've probably never done an interview where Trainspotting hasn't come up, and this will be no exception. But, because I do remember sitting in a cinema, right? And it's that moment, I know you've been asked this a million times, but when he comes down the stairs and you mock up, and I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but feces on these people's faces, was there any part of you during the edit, the shooting, where you thought, I know we're rock and roll people, but we can't do this?
This is too far.
Or did you always believe in it?
The wonderful thing about it being in a privileged position to make a movie is that the contract with the audience is they want you to push.
Yeah.
Push the envelope, as they say. They want you to really get there. If they want to see regular stuff, they've got their television. But they want to go, and they want to have a special reason to go there. So, and it's all just chocolate anyway. So.
Don't say that. It's lovely to meet you in person in Dublin.
Yeah, very nice to be here. Lovely.
Thanks
very much.
The great Danny Boyle there, talking to me about, well, Trainspotting and the British Olympics, and of course his latest movie, 28 years later, which is in cinemas now, this very day, this very weekend. So do check it out. Lovely to meet Danny Boyle. After the break, Chris Rosser has the week's new movie releases, including his take on 28 years later. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new film releases. This week, we're going to be talking about Rust, that very troubled and indeed tragic Alec Baldwin movie that I think was made 2 years ago at this stage. A fascinating new film called The Last Journey, which, if I'm not mistaken, was Sweden's entry for this year's Oscars. And we were talking to Danny Boyle earlier in the show. We will give you an honest-to-goodness review of 28 years later. And and an honest-to-goodness reviewer. You can't get more of one of those than Chris Wasser, who this week is not only battling a cold, but also allergies. Chris, how are you?
It's a vicious combo, John, but I'm okay. I'll survive. How are you?
I know. Well, if we screw up our courage to the point of sticking, we shall not fail. Very good. Listen, a lot to talk about this week, but I want to start with The Last Journey because I haven't got to it, but people are raving about this. As I mentioned, it was the entry for Sweden in the Oscars, if I'm not mistaken. This isn't or is a documentary. It was very hard for me to tell by looking at the trailer.
It is. It's a bit of a documentary. You could describe it as a non-fiction comedy. It's quite unlike anything else I've seen this year. But it tells the story of a man named Lars Hammer, who was a real man, resident of Köping, Sweden. This beloved school teacher who taught French in a secondary school in Sweden, retired at the age of 65. And we see through, you know, grainy archive footage from 2008 that, you know, his son and his colleagues shot, that, you know, he was loved at the school where he taught, you know, by his colleagues who were sad to see him go, his students who couldn't believe he wouldn't be in the classroom anymore. But he decided, look, I've dedicated my life to this job for the last 30 years. I'm going to spend my golden years traveling the world with my wife, Tina. I'm going to, you know, go back to the south of France, which is, you know, as we understand it, Lars's favorite place on earth. He had all of these grand adventures planned and he never did any of them. For whatever reason, John, he lost his spark. He, you know, stopped leaving the house. He got stuck in his armchair. And this happens to so many people after they retire. But Philip, Lars's son, couldn't believe that it happened to his dad. So Lars is now, you know, at the beginning of this film, 80 years of age. As I say, doesn't leave the house. Is struck down with various ailments, you know, but his mind is still sharp. His body is slowing down and he doesn't really have much of a zest for life anymore. You know, he's actually, you know, at one stage he kind of, you know, accepts the fact that he might die soon and that he's okay with that. But as I said, Philip, his son, is not okay with that. So his son Philip is this TV personality, a very popular TV personality in Sweden. It might be a bit reductive and simple to describe Philip and his friend Fredrik Wikinson as the Swedish Anton Deck, but I will do so just to kind of give you some context in that, you know, wherever one guy goes, the other one tends to follow. They're a duo. They're broadcasters, journalists, you know, professional jokers, huge in Sweden. But what they've done here is they've decided to come together and make this plan for Lars to rediscover his smile. So what they do is they track down this busted orange Renault 4, this thing that can't go any faster than 40 kilometers an hour. You know, because Lars used to drive one in the 1980s whenever he was traveling, they arrange a father, son, and friend holiday to the south of France, as I say, Lars' favorite place in the world. And they head off on what Lars describes as this last journey. And along the way, they try to literally stage and recreate moments from Lars's past. Now, I know like some listeners might be like, well, that's a bit much in terms of, you know, trying to, you know, help the father kind of rediscover, you know, the joys of life. It is, but apparently that's all part of the Philip and Frederick appeal.
Okay. Now, that sounds fascinating on one level because it's a documentary of sorts. I mean, they're recreating moments from the past and you see that happening more and more in documentaries. But this idea of taking a parent or a relation or a loved one for one last spin of the dice, whatever that dice may be, we've seen that plenty of times. So what makes this so affecting? Not that you've told me it's affecting, but I gather it's very affecting.
Oh, it is. What makes it different is it's kind of, it is, you know, it's our job to describe what these things are like, John. But this one, you know, this one stumped me a bit because it is a documentary and everything that, you know, this is a true story and it's all happening in front of us. But it's been framed in such a way that it's like Philip and Frederick said, let's not, you know, have any talking heads here. Let's kind of, you know, assemble this like a road movie comedy. So parts of it, you know, you can't really give Lars and all of these real life figures a script to work by, but you can tell that behind the scenes, they've been like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if this happens next? And wouldn't it be sad if we kind of do this thing? And that sounds a little bit emotionally manipulative, and maybe it is, but when it's as effective as it is here, you don't really care. I spent the first few minutes wondering, how did they do this? And then later on, just kind of, you know, I was under its spell. It's hilarious. Okay. It's desperately sad at times, a real heartbreaker. And it starts out as this documentary about, you know, an elderly man saying that, you know, he's no longer, you know, learning to love life again, but saying that, you know, he no longer has any interest in anything, even himself. And it starts out as this film about, you know, his son trying to, you know, bring him back, trying to make him love life again. But then it becomes something else entirely. It becomes this gorgeous comedy about a son finding out firsthand that, you know, time catches up with us all. And this, it becomes less of a film about Lars and more of a film about Philip realizing that, you know, there is a time limit, you know, on his dad, that, you know, even superhero dads will one day disappear. Mm. And he can't quite accept that. And it becomes a lot more interesting too when his friend, Frederick, who was in on this thing with them and, you know, is totally supportive, has to turn around and say to him, we can't reverse time here, Philip. And I see what you're doing and I see how much this affects you, but you might be pushing a bit hard. So Frederick, fair play to him, is the person in the film who's saying the things that we're thinking at home, yeah. You know?
This sounds kind of wonderful. So what are you going to say stars-wise for The Last Journey?
I loved it. I don't know how much of, you know, Frederick and Philip I'll watch after this. I was, you know, I was intrigued, you know, and I went away and fell down a rabbit hole to see what other kinds of things they've done. And that idea of, you know, staging, you know, like at one stage, John, like the two of them, they hire actors to create this fictionalized moment of road rage where on the side of the road where Lars is having his lunch. And they also try and stage a conversation with old friends that Lars hasn't seen in years. To be like a conversation that he had with them 40 years ago, just to kind of bring back his storytelling abilities. Now, when I'm describing it, it might sound, again, a bit too much, but when the lads do it, it's actually very, very funny. But that's the sort of thing that these guys do in their television work. They've done it with their family. It's very effective. It's so funny. It's lovely. It had me in tears. It, you know, you cannot watch it without thinking about your own relationship with your dad, and you're thinking to yourself, and I was just thinking, like, if you watch this thing and you're lucky enough to have your dad in your life, go see him. Go hang out with them, you know, and also don't let this film pass you by.
So that's a beautiful answer, but you still haven't told me the star rating.
I'm going to go with the five, full five.
Wow, a full five. He doesn't give them out often, folks. The Last Journey, select cinemas, general release, a mix of both.
Yeah, you'll find it in some independent cinemas around the country. It might pop up in a few multiplexes, but it's not a full nationwide release. So you might have to go looking for it, but it's worth
it. Okay. Yeah, it definitely sounds like you should go and see it. I'm not going to play a clip because it's in Swedish and we don't do that here. We don't rattle anyone's bag. Eager listeners will get the reference. Tell me this. We move now to Rust. This is in cinemas from... No, it's not. It's on demand. It's getting a digital release from Monday, the 23rd of June. You may not know the title Rust, but you certainly know the controversy about this movie, because this was shot a couple of years ago and the cinematographer died. Helena Hutchins, the cinematographer on Rust, was accidentally, it has been found in a court of law, shot from a gun fired by Alec Baldwin. Chris, you know, there's a lot we could get into on this movie, whether it should have seen the light of day or not, considering the tragedy around it. Do we know why it's being released now? Was it always being planned to release?
Yes and no. So yeah, there might be some listeners thinking, why is this thing getting released? But remember, it's not the first film where this horrific onset accident occurred and then, you know, the filmmakers went back and finished it. Obviously, the most famous example is The Crow with Brandon Lee. But here we have this strange case where the family of Helena Hutchins went to Joel Souza, the director here, who, let's not forget, was wounded with the same bullet that actually kills the cinematographer on this film. So, you know, he wasn't in a position where, you know, or he wasn't really, you know, crying out for this film to be finished. Like, he wasn't interested in actually coming back, but the family went and said, we would actually like this to be completed. I think maybe, John, it might be this sort of sense of, this can't all be for nothing.
Yeah.
But also there's a very complicated lawsuit there where the family will, you know, where the family kind of won a case where they will only maybe receive their settlement from the profits of this film. It's all very complicated, but that's not why they're doing it. The family wanted it done in Helena's memory. So Joel Souza, not wanting anyone else to finish it, went back and filmed this. So we're talking about a film that started production in 2021, resumed in April, May 2023, and is now getting a low-key digital release, which is probably the best thing for it, I think.
Okay, so that's obviously a very difficult situation for all concerned, and I get the logic of its release when you frame it in those terms, and it be some kind of tribute to Helena Hutchins, you could see it as. So, but just in terms of the movie itself, it's a Western, Obviously, people know Alec Baldwin is in it. He plays a man called Harlan Rust, right?
He does, yes. He came up with the story originally with Joel Souza, and Souza went away and wrote and directed this. So he's playing a man named Harlan Rust, who is an outlaw and also a grandfather. And his teenage grandson, Lucas, played by Patrick Scott McDermott, the teenager is sentenced to death following an accidental shooting on his late father's land. Now, I realize that is an unfortunate starting point, you know, a film about an accidental shooting for this to have occurred.
Absolutely.
But we kind of just have to soldier on with this. So Harland is this man who, you know, you don't want to cross. Like, he's got this mean stare. He obviously has a murky past. You know, he's not immediately in his grandson's life. He only appears after the grandson is sentenced to a hanging. So he travels to Wyoming territory. We're in 1882 to break Lucas out of jail. And, you know, Lucas is kind of kicking against it, but he says, what other choice have you got? You know, he throws him over his shoulder onto a horse and says, we're heading for Mexico. Unfortunately, they might not get there because not only do they have this marshal on their tail, Josh Hopkins, there playing the marshal, who's quite conflicted. It has his own stuff happening at home. They also have a very unstable bounty hunter played by Travis Fimmel chasing them down, you know, to kind of, you know, so that he can pick up his own reward. So it's a bit of a, you know, an old school Western, bit of a chase film. Away we go.
Yeah, it sounds almost like a outlaw Josie Wales or something along those lines. So look, I mean, you've said what it's about, old school Western. Is Baldwin good in it?
He is. I think everyone's good in this thing. This is the thing. It's not a bad film, John. You know, it's a stronger, tidier Western than whatever that thing that Kevin Costner gave us last year. You know, like that was
American Saga, right?
Horizon, American Saga. Yeah. It's a better Western than that. It's sort of, you know, a Western of the dusty old school variety. Yeah. You know, here's the good bad guy, and here's the good guy, and here's some guys that haven't yet decided on which side of the field they're playing, and they're all kind of, you know, chasing one another across Wyoming territory in 1882, and like that's, you know, this thing has been done so many times before, but when it's done as effective as this, I'm okay with that because it is steadily performed. It's a beautiful looking film, I should say. You know, like Helena Hutchins shot around 50% of this.
Okay.
And then another cinematographer was obviously brought in to complete it. So we should say that, you know, part of the reason this film works so well is because of the way that it looks. I'm glad that they completed it. I know some people might not be happy about that, and some people are definitely not happy about this film's rollout. When Souza went back to work on this thing, crew members decided, no, we're not doing this. Some actors were no longer available. I do wonder if some actors just didn't want to.
Yeah.
So you had this thing where Souza had to bring it. Like, for instance, Lucas, the main character, the kid, played by Patrick Scott McDermott, wasn't the original kid. So they had to like reshoot scenes. They had to edit around scenes that maybe they couldn't go back and reshoot. So it must have been not just a nightmare to make for obviously very terrible, tragic reasons, but a nightmare to then reassemble and edit. So for it to turn out to not be a disaster in terms of, you know, we're looking at it straight from sort of, you know, is this a good or a bad film? For it not to be a disaster, I think that's an achievement in itself.
Yeah. So look, simply on its own terms, I mean, you and I are tasked here with reviewing movies. So if we can almost be cruel and park all that went on around it, and not that we should, but just for the purposes of reviewing it as a movie, what would you say stars-wise for Rust?
Yeah, you're right. There is no easy way around it. And, you know, we can only be as respectful as we are being, I think. You know, it's a film that is marred by awful circumstances, a terrible tragedy. But I do think it deserves a look in. For Joel Souza, who put the effort in here, and for Helena Hutchins, who did a wonderful job behind the camera, and this film is dedicated to her. You know, she receives second credit in the credits. You know, there's a lovely note at the end for her. I'm going to go with 3 stars.
Okay. And as you pointed out, this is very much a digital release as things stand, so you will find it on various platforms. Let's take a quick clip of Rust.
The only order that exists in this world is the order we impose. If a man loses sight of that, he's got nothing.
God bless the wicked. They continue to pay my bills.
Some things in this life you can't get back, I reckon.
a clip there from Rust, which is getting a digital-only release as of now. So it's findable on all sorts of places. Chris Wasser's giving it 3 stars. Now, Chris, I spoke to Danny Boyle earlier in the show, which was great to do. We talked a lot about 28 Years Later, so you don't need me, or I don't need you to go through what it's all about, because listeners have already heard that. I enjoyed this. It wasn't what I was expecting, but I still thought it was a pretty entertaining movie, shy of 2 hours, so it was the right side of 2 hours. What did you make of 28 Years Later?
I thought it was okay. But, you know, when you wait this long for a 28 Days Later sequel, I know that we already had 28 weeks later, okay doesn't really cut us. I mean, whereas the first one, you know, imagine this bleak, terrifying urban apocalypse, this one is more of a folk horror. And we're talking, you know, the original was so influential, so genuinely terrifying, you know, and original. I know, you know, you know, without George A. Romero's Dead films, you wouldn't have 28 Days Later, but at the time it felt like a real original, and it felt like nothing else in the zombie apocalypse genre. I know Danny Boyle doesn't like to call them that, but it is that. This one feels like everything else that followed 28 Days Later. You know, it a little bit at times. I mean, the things that separated are, you know, Alex Garland's story. You know, if you look hard enough, you'll find sort of, you know, analogies and allegories about real life. You know, this idea of the UK being cut off from Europe and so on and so forth. And also the techniques behind it. You know, they shot the original on these, you know, Canon handheld digital video cameras. This time they're doing it, you know, on iPhone 15s with numerous attachments around it. You know, he's not running around the place just holding his phone. So some of it is effective, you know, in terms of the visuals and the storytelling. But I was never really terrified. And that's a real shame, because that
did you not enjoy some of the chases, though? I thought some of the chases were great.
There's one chase in it that I thought was superb. You mentioned the fact that, you know, the survivors here are cut off from the mainland by this tidal causeway on an offshore island off the British Isles. And when you see that causeway at the beginning of the film and everyone keeps talking about the tide coming in, you're thinking, well, someone's going to have to swim that, being chased by a zombie. And there's a sequence where Aaron Taylor-Johnson's character and his son Spike, they are chased by one of the alpha males, you know, one of the flesh eaters. And the sound design, the visuals, the terror, that all worked there. I would have liked a bit more of that. I'm not saying that I wanted the entire film to be all zombie chases. You need something a bit more thoughtful, a bit more intelligent than that. But I wasn't sure if the tone worked well with this one. You know, there's some unfortunate comedy in there, particularly towards the end of the film, which didn't sit right with me. There are times when it all seems a bit ordinary, which is a shame because, you know, as I say, that first film was so extraordinary. Sometimes it doesn't really know what to do with its cast members and that really, or its characters, and that. And the longer it goes on, you realize it's because it's only half a film. And I don't think I'm spoiling anything there by saying that. The next one is already in the can. The next one is already in January. So when it does end, you're thinking to yourself, bit cheated. You know, this thing is not a television series. They should be complete stories on the big screen. It shouldn't just fade to black and you wait 6-7 months for the next one. So look, it's nicely performed. Jodie Comer is very good in there. Aaron Taylor Johnson, you know, does what he can. He's, you know, he does have a bit of a limited range, but we won't go into that. Ray Fiennes is enjoying himself as the sort of Colonel Kurtz like figure of the tale. You know, it'd be interesting to see where he goes. I don't feel like an award, you know, a full verdict until I see the rest of it.
So based on what you did see, what are you going to say stars wise? And he has seen the whole movie. He's making reference to the fact that there's more to come. So what are you going to say stars wise for 28 years later?
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't walk out of the film. I definitely wouldn't walk out of anything that Danny Boyle does or a 28 Days Later film. It does what it needs to. It's freaky, but it's never terrifying. You know, it looks nice at times. Sometimes it's a bit messy. I wasn't really sure about the archive footage being thrown in. You know, that choppy Danny Boyle editing thing that he likes to do. So look, it's a film with a lot of problems, but I'm going to go with a cautious 3 stars. Do watch it, and we'll come back in 6, 7, 8 months, whatever it is, after the next sequel, and we'll deliver a full verdict.
Yeah, I'd give it a wholehearted 3 stars, but Chris Wasser is giving 28 Years Later a cautious 3 stars. He's giving Rust 3 stars as well, but the movie of the week, unquestionably for Chris, is The Last Journey, which he's giving 5 stars to. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there reviewing the week's new release. I think he was a bit harsh on 28 Years Later. It's different than the other movies, but I liked it. I'm not a million miles away from a 4 on it. I found it's snuck back into my head a few times since I've seen it. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the cast and creator of Squid Game. Yes, we're going to be doing much of it in translation. So tune in for that, because Squid Game is coming back, by golly. I'm also all going to plan, going to be talking to Lena Dunham. Yes, she, the creator of Girls, about her new series that's coming to Netflix, Too Much, that she co-created. That's all to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Friday is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Stay safe in the sun. I'll leave you with a little music from the movies. Suzanne Vega is back with a new album, but I'm going to play one of her classics from the movie Pretty in Pink. This is Left of Center. So I will leave you with that. Wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.
If you want me, you can find me left of center off of the strip. In the outskirts,